Life in Savannah is returning to pre-pandemic norms rapidly these days, and that includes on the live music front. This week, we learned the new venue at Plant Riverside, District Live, will host its debut show on August the 24th and has a full schedule of acts booked through the end of the calendar year. My Savannah Morning News colleagues Laura Nwogu and Zach Dennis join today's Commute Podcast to discuss. You are listening to the Commute Podcast presented by National Office Systems. I am your host, Adam Van Brimmer, back in the chair after a week's vacation. My thanks to Raisa Habersham and Zach Dennis for filling in while I was gone. Today's episode focuses on the soon-to-open District Live music venue at Plant Riverside. And later in this podcast, sports reporter Dennis Knight fills us in on the baseball future of Benedictine star Carter Holton. We'll cue up those discussions right after I do the National Office Systems ad. Here at the Savannah Morning News, we recently reopened our offices, and it's been great to see staffers in person regularly again. It helps that we have a great space, designed and outfitted by Scott Center's team at National Office Systems. And we're not the only ones. National Office Systems has been working with Savannah area businesses for 30 years and leverages its partnerships with suppliers such as Dirt Modular Interiors and Herman Miller Furniture to deliver a top quality product. Learn more by visiting www.natoffsys.com. That's NATOFFSYS.com. I'm going to open the commute today by talking a little bit about the new live entertainment venue down at Plant Riverside, which seems to be the gift that keeps on giving down there from Richard Kessler with Plant Riverside. And that is called District Live. And joining me to talk a little bit about it is Laura Nwogu, who wrote about it for the Savannah Morning News in today's paper? Monday's paper.
Monday's
paper. And, of course, new editor Zach Dennis, who can put it in context of what that venue means in terms of live music scene in Savannah. So, Laura, let's start with you. People in Savannah have heard that this was coming, and it was heard that it involved Live Nation, which meant that top-quality acts. But now that it's official, now that they've announced the lineup, can you kind of put it in context of what this facility is going to be for Savannah, and who's on the lineup that maybe we should be excited about this coming?
Yeah, so District Live is a new venue. Plant Riverside District is right across from the main building, and it's a 500 capacity venue. They plan to have a lot of acts there, they plan to bring in a lot of big names, but they're trying to bring in local acts as well. People like Amos Lee is on the lineup, Savannah native group Pacifier. And so, yeah, right now it's a 500 capacity venue they're looking at, and that's standing room. And they just want to kind of elevate the music scene in Savannah. Obviously, there are some live music venues, but their goal is to bring a new world-class experience, a first-class experience to live music in Savannah.
I noticed in the story it noted that Richard Kessler, the Kessler Collection Hotels, which is a national hotels all over the country, has an existing relationship with Live Nation. Did you get a sense of how that existing relationship played into getting this venue going?
Yeah, so this partnership has been in talks for years, about 3 years now. And so the Kessler Collection and Live Nation have been planning this. And it's the first Live Nation partnership in Savannah. And they also have a partnership with Ticketmaster that they're trying to push through. That's where people can get their tickets. So those two partnerships are kind of the big things that are going to make District Live what it is.
Mm-hmm. Zach, obviously Live Nation and Ticketmaster are, I think, they're the same company now. I think one bought the other.
Yeah.
And we got a new arena opening. We have...
Also Live Nation.
They are doing the booking for the new arena.
Yeah.
Okay, so when you look at this and you see this, is this kind of the test of waters ahead of the arena, or is this all going to work together in terms of how they're booking based on venues and acts?
It'll be interesting because, you know, you have the arena, which is over there in West Savannah, which is going to be kind of its own district, which it, you know, looks great, but we don't know necessarily how people are going to react to that initially. With District Live, I feel like you have that built-in River Street. You have those tourists who are staying at Plant Riverside or any of the other hotels around there who are already going to be going to that spot. And I think the big takeaway especially is just that you have a 500 person capacity venue, which is something, you know, Savannah's had a really strong live music scene for a while. I mean, a lot of those venues locally, especially in that area of downtown, have kind of gone away. We talked about places like the Jinx, Bayou Cafe, places like that. But this kind of elevates it more, just rather than kind of getting those solid acts or kind of waiting for a Savannah Music Festival or a Savannah Stopover to bring in those named acts that people kind of know. This will put Savannah, you know, in that level of the Charlestons and Charlottes and places like that, where when people are traveling around there, they have a venue to kind of match that.
Right. And Laura, I know you made a point in the story to talk about, you know, Savannah has, they have the bars that have 100, 150. They have the theaters that have 800 to 1,000. They have, at least for now, the Johnny Mercer Theater, which is 2,500. And eventually we're going to have an arena that has, what is it, Zach, up to 7,000 is what they're saying.
Something like that, yeah.
For concerts. So what is this 500 venue? Is this a sweet spot, you think?
I think it is. You mentioned, Zach, there was a venue that already has in Starland District.
Yeah, Victory North is kind of the same build, but
it's a little smaller though, right? And it's more standing room, and it's not a theater type.
Yeah, and it was one that was kind of I've been there for a number of shows, and it's a wonderful venue, but it was also kind of getting its feet wet, and then the pandemic happened, and so I think also, you know, Starland's on the rise, but I think again you have to think of that location right there on River Street being the key,
right? And that's another key point is in talking to the folks at Point Riverside, they have built-in audience with tourists and visitors staying there. How much value are they putting on locals attending their shows?
Yeah, so Point Riverside District, they actually have been doing live shows in the main building. In some of the restaurants, they do some piano nights, they do jazz nights. So a lot of those are local artists, and they were also free offerings. So they kind of have that built-in relationship with local musicians and artists already. So obviously, the partnership with Live Nation, it'll bring in big names. But you also want to think about the local musicians who have been performing, you know, at these venues for years now. So they do have a goal to bring in local artists to this big new venue.
Before we talk 50,000-foot view, Zach, I want to follow up one more thing with Laura, and that was that part of the new venue is going to have a museum or a display or something in terms of Gresh, which is a local company.
Yeah.
Fred and his wife live here locally, lived here a long time. They're based out in Pooler. They have a drum manufacturing plant up the road in Ridgeland. They're famous, and I'm going to butcher this because I should have looked it up, but George Harrison played a Gretsch guitar in some famous Beatles. That's where it all stems from. And I probably mixed up Eric Clapton with George Harrison, but I'm almost sure it's George Harrison. Regardless, can you talk about the relationship with Gretsch and what they're going to have in there in terms of a venue for people to kind of check out?
Yeah, so it's basically going to be a display in the lobby and also the performance venue. And so guest patrons will be able to read about their history and their legacy, but I believe there will also be some drums. I don't know if they'll be able to play them, but there will be some stuff displayed in the lobby, so people, while they listen to the music, they can also learn about music history. And I just showed the emphasis on music and its history and its importance to Savannah, but also in general.
As somebody who has a kid that has a drum set, and every other kid to visit my house pounds on the drums, I'm hoping that they're not just handing out sticks to everybody comes to the door, but regardless. Zach, so you mentioned that Victory North was bringing in bigger name acts. Of course, they have a relationship with a booking agency that is very active, Atlanta, Athens, the whole Southeast. Of course, Savannah Music Festival has established our reputation going back more than 20 years. More recently, Savannah Stopover has become a pretty big deal as bands are going up and down the East Coast and then maybe over to South by Southwest. When you take all of that in totality and put it together, what does Live Nation, what does District Live,
mm-hmm.
how do all the puzzle pieces go together, and what's it going to mean for Savannah as a music scene?
I think it's going to open up a lot of those acts, like I said before, that you're seeing come through with the music festival. I mean, you know, you have people like Amethyst Kia, who's big on the rise, you know, top performing artist. People like that who are coming through the music festival, well, maybe now when they're on tour, they'll consider coming here because they can fill out a big venue, whether it's District Live or it's the, you know, City Arena, whatever it is, like that's more of a draw than coming to, you know, now you had the music festival, you had Stopover, which were bringing, you know, strong acts, and they were having great performances at places like Ships of the Sea, the Jinx before it closed, Congress Street Social Club, and those are all great venues, but it just didn't have the capacity to draw in those, just those premier acts. And I think that with the arena, with District Live, now those folks who you are more accustomed to seeing in Atlanta or, like I said, Charlotte or Charleston, and not just music, but also, you know, comedians, performers. I think it even elevates it over what, because they just, Live Nation just has a bigger reach than what the Johnny Mercer and, you know, the city was doing previously there. So you're tapping into a much wider pool that, you know, Savannah just really hasn't had. And so I think that's kind of the draw that you're getting there.
Yeah. And it'll be interesting to see with some of the Stopover Savannah Music Festival, does this venue work into those festivals?
You would hope so, because, yeah, I mean, the music festival's done a good job. I mean, they perform a lot downtown at places. I mean, they do Ships of the Sea as well, which is kind of an underrated venue in terms of music.
Talk about the Outdoor Garden.
Yeah, it's such a wonderful place. I mean, I've gone to a number of Stopover shows there, and it's great. But, I mean, they're playing at, like, the Lucas. They're playing at Ships of the Sea. They did that big outdoor thing a couple years ago.
Trustees.
And that's all well and good, but like those places aren't necessarily designated music spots 24/7. You know, those are just kind of specialty, like Ships of the Sea will at the Jazz Festival do something or Stopover do something. And so having this where maybe those places can kind of tap into these, because I think it only helps them, because Stopover can go, you know, they can go to their acts and be like, we have this, you know, 500 person venue that we can fill up. You know, maybe we can go for somebody a little bit bigger than they're normally getting. Same with the music festival, just because they can bring that, you know, partnership and be like, look what we have. And so, again, I don't think it's, you know, I saw the quote in Laura's story about, you know, the music scene being dead. That's not true. I think it's more, it's taking you from one level and elevating it up a level, because I think it's just going to help all of these different places and these different organizations kind of do more.
Yeah. As Zach said it very nicely, I wrote about it in my Savannah Town Square Facebook group today, and I was not as kind, so Zach's much kinder than I am. But Mr. Gray, who is the entertainment director over there at Plant Riverside, will watch his words a little bit more.
Yeah, and the thing that I also hope it opens up, and this is just, I guess, my concern with Live Nation, I'll just, you know, play devil's advocate, is it also, you know, to that quote, the live music scene is kind of, I would say, not struggling, but with places like the Jinx closing and places like Bayou Cafe closing, where the people who are based here in Savannah are playing, that's taking a little bit of a hit. And there's been some night, we've written about it in Due. We had a story a couple weeks ago about the Seawolf out on Tybee is doing a singer-songwriter series. And places like that have kind of picked that up, but it's more acoustic, smaller, you know, smaller places. And I hope that Victory North, which is going to have an all Savannah musician show on Thursday. I hope that District Live, the arena, I hope they also incorporate some of our locals, because we have a really talented local base who kind of would love to like have that opportunity to play on that stage. And so maybe that's something as well, working with Stopover, working with music, you know, there's an opportunity there. And so I hope that's a possibility.
Yeah, it's going to be worth looking into is how do you establish a relationship with Live Nation? How do you get to play within there? Because they run the venue, so they have a little bit of a power there. And like you said, with local acts, and it's encouraging that we already have one booked in for the first 6 months, right? The reggae band.
Yeah.
And of course, there's some other, Future Birds is a big traveling band, and one of their musicians is based here. And I know they're playing at Victory North. What are some of the other big local bands? I guess Liquid Ginger, maybe not so much anymore. But
yeah, well, like this Thursday at Victory North, they're doing, and this is the kind of thing that I love to see, and what I love about Victory North is they're doing this homegrown summer jam that's kind of run by Eric Britt, who's a local. He really cut his teeth in the Athens scene in the 90s, and he has this new band, I think it's the New American Holograms, which it's an Americana, folk music, and so they're kind of headlining it. But then he also has a number of other Americana folk artists like Jason Bible, Matt Eckstein, people like that who are all, they're all, it's just kind of, it's a very, I feel like it's going to be a very low-key affair that's also promoting local artists. And so I kind of hope to see that, whether it's not just the Americana scene, but the hip-hop scene, right, the rock scene. We have such a robust heavy metal scene. Aurifest does a really good job. I mean, they're doing shows at the Sentient Bean. It would be really cool if they could do something in Victory North or District Live.
Bigger venue.
Exactly.
Yeah. And that brings up a good point as well, that Laura, you have your story, that it looks like they're looking for diversity in terms of genres.
Yeah.
And I think the initial lineup kind of reflects that.
Yeah, it was a lot of country, pop, rock, obviously the reggae band, alternative. So they're trying to dip their feet in different genres. So it gives the people, you know, different people what they want to listen to.
So the lineup is on SavannahNow.com at Laura's Story. You go on SavannahNow.com. If you don't see it immediately, go to the little magnifying glass and put in District Live, and it'll return it. You can take a look at that lineup. I believe the tickets go on sale next week.
I think it's this Friday, actually.
The 16th, is that this Friday?
I think it's this Friday, yeah. And I would also recommend and do this week, Bill Doors wrote a column kind of working off Laura's story, just talking a little bit, some of what I'm talking about, where just what this means for the music scene and what to kind of expect. Because he's talking with him, he's very excited about the acts that they have so far.
Yeah. Good stuff. Laura, thank you for your work. Zach, thanks for the insights. It's always good to talk to you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Before we move on to baseball and the Major League Baseball draft status of BC's Carter Holton, I'd like to take a minute to talk about the things we do here at the Savannah Morning News and SavannahNow.com Beyond podcasts. Put simply, we deliver the best in local news coverage. We go in-depth on topics important to you, whether it's Savannah's city manager search or the best new restaurants around town. If you aren't a subscriber, now's the time to try us out. You can get full access to our digital content for $1 a month for the next 6 months. All those stories marked subscriber only on our website, this gets you behind that paywall. So dig under those couch cushions or check the pockets of those pants you put in the laundry for some coins or some small bills and sign up today. Go to SavannahNow.com/subscribe now to sign up. Now, here's sports reporter Dennis Knight on BC's Carter Holton.
Round out today's commute with a conversation with sports reporter Dennis Knight, who's been busy the last 24 hours, or probably even going back farther than that, dealing with the Major League Baseball draft, and in particular, the fate of, or at least the draft fate, of one of the best baseball players to ever come out of the Savannah area, and Benedictine pitcher Carter Holton, who was projected to be a high pick. And from reading your story today, Dennis, it looks like he might have been a high pick had he assured some of these teams that he was willing to come to them rather than go to school at Vanderbilt. And of course, he wasn't a high enough pick to draw the kind of money, the kind of signing bonus that would dissuade him from coming to Vanderbilt. But when you talked to him, did you get kind of a sense of how conflicted he was through this whole process? Or did it seem like, you know, I think he said in the story, he said, "I have a number." And I assume what he means by the number is, you know, if I get picked in a spot that's going to pay me X amount, then I'll go. But otherwise, I'm going to go to college. Is that an accurate way of portraying what he did?
Yeah, that's exactly what the case was. He had a number in mind, and then when he slipped past that number, he had some teams showing interest in him in the a couple in the third round and one in the fourth round, and that's the money that was slotted at those picks is like the upper six figure, you know, just under $1 million, maybe the 800,000 range, the highest one. But he felt like, you know, he was worth more than that. And he was willing to go to Vanderbilt, and he'll play for 3 years there and then see how his stock rises. There's two guys. Vanderbilt has won two national titles since 2014, the last one coming in 2019. This year, they were second to Mississippi State. And they had two pitchers this year that went in the top 10 overall picks, and Jack Leiter and Kumar Rocker. And those guys made about $8 million and $5 million with their bonus money, respectively.
Right. That's great context there, isn't it? It's, you know, for 3 years and by NCAA rules, baseball's like you have to stay 3 years. It's pretty good context to think that, okay, I could increase my, at least my initial payout from $800,000 to $8 million.
Yeah.
And that kind of gets your attention a little bit, right?
Yeah. And the pitchers that have been coming out of Vandy have been just so high quality. So they got a great coaching staff there. And Carter, from the story I did before on him, he's never really taken formal lessons. His dad kind of taught him how to pitch. And then, you know, of course, Benedictine coaching staff helped him out a lot. But this next level coaching, we'll see how that helps out his pitching and his approach to the game.
Yeah, his mechanics is certainly something that you can always tweak. And, of course, the flip side of that is, well, if you get into the minor league system with a team that they might even have better expertise. But as you said, Vanderbilt has got a pretty good track record for turning out pitchers. A couple of you mentioned, and I know David Price is somebody that always sticks out in my mind because I saw him pitch against Tech back in the day when he played for Vanderbilt. Yeah, they certainly have it going there, to say the least. Of course, the other part of college sports now, especially, and it's come into focus in recent weeks, is the whole idea the rules have changed. The Supreme Court handed down a decision recently that basically says colleges cannot prohibit student athletes from trying to profit off of their name, image, and likeness, which, as we all know, colleges for a long time have printed up jerseys and t-shirts and everything else with the player's number, even the player's name on it, and sold it and got to keep all the money. And that's just a small part of this. So there's a lot of other things involved in name, image, and likeness, but that's the most obvious. And I know that you talked to Benedictine coach Kevin Farmer a little bit about how that might play into Carter's decision. And let's face it, in Nashville, I mean, Vanderbilt's in Nashville, a big town, and baseball is probably the marquee sport at that university. Did Farmer give you any kind of indication on whether that played into Holton's decision? Do we get the feeling that if he's as good as we think he is, that he's going to make tens of thousands of dollars in endorsements or anything else along those lines while at Vanderbilt?
Well, I'm not sure if it played into his decision overall, but we were just talking about all the benefits he's going to get from going to Vanderbilt. You know, it's a very highly rated academic institution. So getting your degree there kind of sets you up for life, especially being in the baseball program too, with the connections you'll have through that. But we were talking about the NIL stuff, and that's going to be a bonus for him. You know, it just started in last month, I guess. And we can only imagine what these guys like Leader and Rocker would have got with, and, you know, Vanderbilt is a national program in baseball that everybody looks at if they're into the college baseball world. So that can be an added bonus for him making the decision to stay with Vandy.
Yeah. And like I mentioned, that being in Nashville, I think there's a lot of businesses in Nashville that want to attach themselves to the baseball program, and he'll get endorsement opportunities, as we've seen with other athletes just in the last couple of weeks since it came down. And we're not just talking about, you know, the premier football players and the premier basketball players. We've seen players ink deals, women's basketball.
Well, he's big into hunting. He's big into hunting and fishing. So maybe he can get like Bass Pro Shops going, you know, with a hat or something like that. That'd be good.
Tennessee, you never know. I know that we talked near the end of the baseball season, kind of where you felt Holton kind of fit in from a historical standpoint. But now that you've had a little bit of time to get away from it, obviously the stats are crazy. His ERA, I think, is the correct me if I'm wrong, the best in state history. It's like 0.59 or something.
Yeah.
Crazy. What, from your perspective, where does he fit in terms of the best players to ever come out of Savannah? I mean, we're talking about Josh Reddick and some others, some pretty big name players. Where does he fit?
I think he's right up there with the best, with the numbers he put up over his career, 31-4 overall pitching record. He had 463 strikeouts and 213 innings. He was on pace to shatter that state career strikeout record. He was only 56 off it. And his junior year was cut short at about 30%, you know. So he was 56 off that record. That's about four games at the most for him with the strikeout rate that he had. So he would have broke that. And just where he sits kind of in the all-time records, and also being a pitcher and a hitter, I mean, the guy had 27 homers, 125 ribbies, a 434 career batting average. So he's a complete player. And I talked to him about that too, you know, with Ohtani going into the All-Star game. I said, they should give you a shot to be a version of Ohtani, you know? And he said, if they gave me the shot, I would take it. And he thought that, you know, he knows it's something that's very unlikely at the pro level, but he said it might be more likely at the college level. And I think he could do it. He showed he can hit, you know, the best pitchers out there. Bubba Chandler from North Oconee, when they played in the state semis, I think he had two doubles and another ball that was hit to the warning track off him as BC beat them, you know. And Chandler got an infield hit off him in the doubleheader.
Oh, there you go.
Game of the doubleheader. But he showed he can – that guy throws 95 miles an hour, and he was squaring it up, you know. So I think if you – you know, I've only been here 10 years, and there's some from way back that like Ken Harrelson for Benedictine. I'm sure he was a great player back in his day, and some of these other guys. But as far as in the last couple decades, I would say he's the best overall coming out of high school with the stats he put up.
And I remember from back when I was sitting your chair, Adam Wainwright, Glenn Academy.
Oh, yeah, Glenn Academy, right?
Yeah, that was back in the day when Glenn Academy was in with all the Savannah public schools, and he was a guy that was pretty remarkable. And it's interesting because I was looking up some stats on him today, and I was looking at his – he went in the first round. Braves took him late in the first round, and his signing bonus was $1.25 million. And I used the Google machine and adjusted it for inflation, and it came out to like $1.96 or $1.97 million was the signing bonus. So that shows you right there that the inflation rate for the country versus the inflation rate for baseball, with some of these other kids getting $8 million, it makes sense for Carter to go the route that he's going.
And Wainwright's if we looked up what he made in his whole career, he's still doing it today. He's having a good season this year.
You mentioned that you've been here a limited amount of time, but you've been covering high school sports on the West Coast before you came here. Have you seen anybody as good as Holton before at the high school level?
Well, probably the best guy I saw on the West Coast was Jock Peterson, who's on the center fielder for the Cubs now. He played at Palo Alto High, which is one of the schools we covered pretty well. And he was a great center fielder in high school. He didn't even go to college. I think he was drafted right out of high school by the Dodgers, went through the minors for a few years. But again, he wasn't a pitcher and a hitter like Carter was. He was just a center fielder, just a major league. But I was actually talking to Carter's dad about that, Carl, and I said, yeah, he just the fact that he does both made him stand out from all the rest that I've covered in my time.
But while I got you, it is July the 13th, and that means we're probably only about 2 weeks away from high school football gearing up, right? Are you anxious? Are you eager? What do you think?
I can't believe it's come up this quick. Yeah, I got to start getting my all my schedules together, you know. But I'm looking forward to it. We got Holden Gurner, who's going to be a senior year here at Benedictine, the quarterback who's committed to Auburn. And Benedictine should have a pretty good team with Justin Thomas. He's committed to UGA as a baseball player. But they got a lot of pieces coming back. Calvary Day with Troy Ford, who has offers from Notre Dame and Georgia Tech. And then their quarterback, who's just a rising sophomore, Jake Merklinger, he just picked up an offer from Michigan State. You know, so we got some quality players in this area, and we'll have some – it should be a great season, I think.
Always good to talk to you, Dennis.
Okay.
Appreciate the time.
Thanks for having me, man.
Thanks for listening to this episode of The Commute and to our presenting sponsor, National Office Systems. Please support them as they support this podcast. If you enjoyed this episode of The Commute and want to hear more, download archived episodes on your podcast app by searching The Commute with @SavannahOpinion. The Commute returns Thursday. We'll talk to you then.